with the Parsha Pinchas, Chumash Bamidbar is drawing to a close. And the Parsha, as we know, begins with a count. So, Rosh Hadas B'nei Yisrael. And we get the family by family and tribe by tribe stock take of the Jewish people. And with this, Parshas Pinchas brackets the other end of Chumash Bamidbar with a count. Bamidbar began with a count, that is to say Parshas Bamidbar, and it ends with a count. We're now in year 40 in Parshas Pinchas. And in fact, the presence of these two countings does not go unnoticed by Chazal. So we've mentioned in the past, the way that we refer to the Chumashim is somewhat, I would say, a matter of convenience. One takes the first prominent word, and there's your Chumash. But Bracious is Bracious. And Shemos is Shemos, Vayikra Vayikra. Bamidbar, that's what we call the Chumash. We're not going to call it Vayidaber, because that might leave us guessing. But the first distinctive word, shall we say, and then Dvarim is Dvarim. Actually, if we were Yekish, we would say Bamidbar, not Bamidbar, but I've never seen anyone take offense to that. But Chazal do not use that system, although it does have precedent also in Chazal. But if you look through the Shas and through the Midrashim, you'll see that it's more characteristic names that are used for the Chumashim, which means that Bereishis is called Chumash HaYetzira. The book of creation, I mean, that's what it's about. Vayikra is Toras Kohanim. It's the Sefer which deals with the halachas of Kohanim. And Devarim, Mishneh Torah, which is in a very broad sense a review then of the Torah. And Chumash Bamidbar is called Chumash HaPekudim, the Chumash of the countings. In this respect, I mean, Lahavdil, but the way that the Chumashim are referred to in English actually more reflects the way Chazal did it. If you think of Genesis and Exodus, I mean, that's the beginning, that's the Geula. Vayikra is called Leviticus. I'm not sure why they didn't call it Kohanicus. It's actually more about the Kohanim than it is about the Levium. But I'm not an expert in those. And Bamidbar is Numbers. And Devarim is Deuteronomy. So, I mean, Lahavdil, some Goy had Seichel. And these are characteristic names. But the question, of course, is, of all of these names, if they really are characteristic, why do you call Chumash Bamidbar the Chumash of the countings? As if to say, all the others really do describe the content of the Chumash. Shemos is Exodus. It is the Chumash HaGeula. I mean, that's what it's about. That's the prime event and topic. And so on and so forth. Bamidbar, Numbers, counting. It's true. There are numbers in it. There are countings in it. But isn't there so much more? I think most people, when you ask them to what the significant events of Chumash Bamidbar, unless they are an actuary or such like, I mean, they're not going to start with the numbers. They'll tell you about the Meraglim and Korach and Balak. I mean, these are the eventful parts of the Chumashim. Everything else is mere, it's a census. I mean, without it, each thing has its place. But that's the Chumash, that's your abiding memory of Chumash Bamidbar, as the Jewish people were counted. I mean, they could be counted today. And this question is discussed by the Netziv in the HaMikdavar in his introduction. And it's an important question. Netziv has a psicha to certain some of the Chumashim. And the Netziv explains, it is true that there are many, many significant and impactful events in Chumash Bamidbar. Many of them, their impact is felt until today. The Meraglim impact of Meraglim is felt until today. We're headed, unless things reverse, to the 3 weeks. From Shavuos HaBetamos to Tisha B'Av. That's the first Tisha B'Av was the evening of the Meraglim. But all of them can be characterized by the countings that happened in the beginning of the Chumash and the end. They don't just bracket the Chumash. They give an overview for what the Chumash is about. And what is the Chumash about? Effectively, says the Netziv, Chumash Bamidbar is about the transition from life in the Midbar to be ready to life in Eretz Yisrael. There is no question that there was a transition to be had. It's a very different type of existence in the Midbar with Moshe, with the Man, with the Mishkan. Things will change. Things will transition. And it did not happen overnight. It did not happen when they're on the 10th of Nisan in year 40, when they were on the one side of the River Jordan, they were in one mode. And when, by the time they crossed over, everything had changed. Transitions take time. We find certainly in the 40th year, things are different. We put all the 40 years of the Midbar together, they're not homogenous. They're not all the same at all. You find in year 40, there's much more of what we could call, at the risk of oversimplifying, a kind of a naturalization process, where Moshe already begins to send delegations to the nations, you start negotiating, there's wars that happen, and it's a somewhat more earthy experience than the first 39 years in the Midbar. But the transition did not just happen over the 40th year. Everything ultimately in Chumash Bamidbar, every significant event is about this transition. And it begins even as soon as the Chumash gets going, so to speak. You have the Misonanim, they're complaining. And what are they complaining about? Part of what it is it's hard for them to abide by life in the Midbar. They're looking for a bit of distance. Kivra Satava, the man is that they remember normal food. And they're looking to naturalize, perhaps in a way which is not healthy for them. And from a certain point of view, one could say the story of Chumash Bamidbar is the story of two clocks. It's Hashem's clock for how we're meant to, his timetable and way and schedule for us to naturalize into, be ready to enter the land of Israel, and it's the Jewish people's clock, and they had a bit of a different clock. It was fast. It ticked faster, and sometimes in an unhealthy way. And the truth is that even the central episode, what we would call in our national experience, of the Meraglim, is also about this question, namely, sending spies. We always come back to this question in Parsha Shalach. Sending spies, is it good for the Jews or not good for the Jews? Is it a good idea or not? Well, as we've seen, it really depends on the way in which we are, what mode are we in? If you're completely reliant on Hashem, if you're absolutely connected in that way, in that elevated way, there's no need for such steps, sending spies. What difference does it make? If you're in a much more earth-like, mundane, one could say, form of existence, of course you need to send spies. You need to do everything that's necessary. So ultimately, the pre-question to whether we need to send spies is how are we at the moment? What mode are we in? If we're still in Midbar mode, and we should have been still in Midbar mode in at that stage, then it's not necessary. We opted in to a more earthly mode, and that, of course, then necessitated the sending of spies, which means the problem didn't start with sending spies. It started by subscribing to a perspective on ourselves which HaKadosh Baruch Hu wasn't yet ready for us to enter into, and we were not ready, and the rest was those 40 years. And therefore, although we've scanned very briefly and comprehensively every significant event, and of course the Meraglim begets Korach, and so on and so forth, is all about this transition. And now, if we look at the two countings, the beginning of Bamidbar, at the end of Bamidbar, and we learn to hear the language of those numbers, each one has a different character, each of those two censuses. And in fact, what divides them is this very question, the mode that we're in. The counting in Chumash Bamidbar is the Jewish people as they are in Midbar mode. The counting in Parshas Pinchas, in our Parsha, is the Jewish people as they are in entering Eretz Canaan mode. And the transition between them is what the whole Chumash is about. How do we see this? It goes from the general, says the Netziv, down to the details. In general, how were we counted? How were we formatted? How were we categorized? Well, in the beginning of Chumash Bamidbar, the count were arranged and assessed in two ways. Firstly, chapter 1, we're counted as tribes, which we were. But then there's a second count. There's a second reckoning in the beginning of Bamidbar, not only as tribes, but also as machanos, also as degolim, also as those camps, four camps of three tribes each. And that's another whole chapter in Parshas Bamidbar. And what is that? Those camps were the Jewish people as they were arranged and aligned around the Mishkan. That's how you live in the Midbar. You are on all four sides of the Mishkan. 40 years later, or just under 40 years later, in our parsha, in Parshas Pinchas, we're counted as tribes, but no longer as machanos. Where did the machanos go? Where did the flags go? Where did the 4 times 3? They were not applicable anymore. They weren't appropriate anymore, because when the Jewish people enter the land of Israel, they're not going to be living around the Beis HaMikdash, four groups of three in that way. They'll be spread out. The only thing you need to know is how many are there in a tribe for purposes of allotting their inheritance. And therefore, Shvatim and Machanos in the beginning of the Chumash, and Shvatim alone at the end of the Chumash, shows you a different type of formatting of the Jewish people, because they're different modes. Midbar mode and Eretz Kanaan mode. And there is a further point. If you watch carefully, we don't always, if we look at the order specifically of Yosef, I mean, Yosef splits up into two for purposes of counting. His two sons assume the status for many purposes of Shvatim, Menashe and Ephraim. Well, who's counted first? Menashe or Ephraim? The answer actually is yes. Because if you look in Parshas Bamidbar, it counts Ephraim first. In our Parsha, it counts Menashe first. And we, of course, are somewhat mystified, because whoever should be first both times. What is behind the order, or the shift of order, of counting Menashe first or Ephraim first? And the answer to this, says the Netziv, will take us back to the time when Ephraim received, as we know, his primacy over Menashe. That took place in Parshas Vayechi, when Yaakov gave them their brachos. So what happens, as we know, it's etched in our minds, Yosef presents them, and Menashe is on Yaakov's right side, and Ephraim's on Yaakov's left side, and then everything's ready, and Yaakov switches his hands. As the Pasuk says, Sikel es yadav, he switched his hands, however you translate the word sikel, ki Menashe abachor, for Menashe is the firstborn. Says the Netziv, I have two questions. And the episode is well known to us. I have two questions. Firstly, why does he switch his hands? As far as he's concerned, there's a bit of a machlokus between him and Yosef as to who should get the right and who should get the left. So Yosef thinks that Menashe should get the right. Well, Yaakov clearly disagreed. So what's with the switching of the hands? As far as he's concerned, they're in the wrong place. He should switch his grandchildren. I mean, it's going to come out sooner or later, as it did. As far as he's concerned, Yosef put them in the wrong place, and Yaakov decides. It would have looked a little differently, but that's the first question. It's a somewhat deconstructive question, because we can't imagine what it would be like without him switching his hands. But switch them! Secondly, ask the Netziv, look at the Pasuk, and Rishonim have asked this question. The Pasuk says, Sikel es yadav ki Menashe ha-Bechor. He switched his hands because Menashe's the Bechor. Says the Netziv, that's not a very good reason for switching your hands. That's actually the reason for not switching your hands. If you want to switch them, you need a different reason. I mean, if you can imagine in conversational form, if we ask Derech She'ela and Tshuva, the question is, why did Yaakov switch his hands? The answer is, because Menashe is the firstborn. So that should have you leave your hands where they are. Which is a good shaila. Our Rabbi Nel asked this question, Rabbi Nebachya and others. But that is why says the Netziv, in fact, the matter is more nuanced than we normally understand. It's more blended than we think. For when we ask the question, who should receive primacy, or however we'll define it, Menashe or Ephraim, as far as we're concerned, it's either or. It's either Menashe or Ephraim. But the truth is, primacy comes in many forms. There are spiritual matters, there are material matters, there are political matters, there are military matters, there are financial matters. I mean, there's different spheres in which one could talk about ascendancy and primacy, and who is the who's alpha and who's beta. And here, says the Netziv, the whole idea that Ephraim received the right hand, which means Ephraim receives primacy, but it's not true with regards to everything. It's true with regards to spiritual matters. I mean, look who came out of Ephraim's Yehoshua, and he performs miracles, and he's the one that gives us Eretz Yisrael, and so on and so forth. But Menashe remains the Bechor, and it counts for something. It means that in more material matters or more temporal matters, Menashe, he is the one that has primacy. And this situation comes out whereby if Menashe is at Yaakov's right, but to be at Yaakov's right side, that is to say by his right leg, and Ephraim is at Yaakov's left side, and presumably wherever side you are, you get the hand also, but the hand and the leg refer to different aspects of that the destiny and the possibilities of that tribe. The leg is the more earthy part, it has contact with, it gives mobility, and so on and so forth. The hand represents Chochmah, a person writes, a person expresses. And therefore, says in the Tziv, Yaakov did not switch the placing of his grandchildren because they're exactly where they need to be. Menashe is at his right side, he needs to be at his right side. Because in terms of what the right side represents, the right leg of Yaakov, Menashe should get the Yamin, and Ephraim should get the small. But in terms of what the hands represent, which are the somewhat more spiritual matters, there it's reversed. Ephraim should get the right, and Menashe should get the left. Which means that actually, both Menashe and Ephraim got the right and the left. Menashe got the right leg and the left hand. Ephraim got the right hand and the left leg. And that's why the Pasuk describes this and explains it. Sikeles Yadav. He switched his hands. You know why he switched his hands and left them where they were? Ki Menashe HaBechor, because Menashe is the Bechor. It didn't go away. He still receives his element of primacy represented by him being at Yaakov's right side. Well, Achar HaDvarim HaEle, if we come back to Chumash Bamidbar, and we now ask the question of the two sons of Yosef, of the two branches of the tribe of Yosef, Menashe and Ephraim, who should be counted first? Naturally, we'll respond, whoever's more prominent should be counted first. But now the question is, well, who's more prominent? And the answer is, it depends. What sphere are we talking about? If we're talking about the temporal sphere, Menashe is the Bechor, he is more prominent. If we're talking about the more spiritual sphere, Ephraim is the more prominent. And therefore, says the Netziv, in Chumash Bamidbar, in the beginning of the Chumash, where we're yet in Midbar mode, when we're yet in that elevated spiritual plane, primacy is given to the one who has spiritual primacy, and that's why Ephraim is counted first. That's why it's shifted, reversed. In our parsha, as we come to naturalize more, as we come to the more temporal way, of course everything is relative, but in that respect, who has primacy there, and who should be counted first? Menashe, he's the Bechor, and Menashe is counted first. And therefore it turns out, as is often the case, if you hear the music of the numbers, you'll understand, says Netziv, the reason why Chazal referred to this Chumash as the Chumash of the counting, they're not ignoring all of the events that took place in between these two countings. They're framing these events. They're giving us a perspective, they're giving us a canvas upon which to appreciate them, because the transition that all these events deal with, each one in its time, is actually reflected in the two countings, in the beginning and the end, and hence the name of the Chumash, Now, I'd like to move a bit further. There's many korbanos and moadim in Parshas Pinchas, But one of the Musafim is that of Rosh Chodesh, and we take sometimes a Parshas Pinchas occasion to discuss certain matters of Rosh Chodesh. And I would like to devote some time to discussing an element, an aspect that comes with the Rosh Chodesh for us, and that is Kiddush Levana, what's called blessing the moon. It's certainly one of the more enigmatic things that we do. I think people who are being newly introduced to Torah Judaism, I don't think Kiddush Levana is the first thing that they are initiated into. But really, that's just another way of saying that everyone needs to understand a little bit deeper what Kiddush Levana is about. The Gemara says, and the source of Kiddush Levana actually is not in Maseches Brachos, where we might expect with the other Brachos, it's actually in Maseches Sanhedrin for various reasons, and Daf Mem Gimel. And there, the Gemara says, Haroa Levana b'chidusha, a person who sees the moon as it's being renewed, so Chayav Levarech, so he makes the Bracha, or Mevarech, the bracha that we know, Asher B'Mamaro, Baruch Shachim, etc. The center of Kiddush Levana is that bracha. And interestingly, before we get into perhaps some of the details of Kiddush Levana, the important core question is, what type of bracha is this? When you see the new moon, or the moon as it's being renewed, you make a bracha. What type of bracha is this? And let us explain the question. I mean, how many types could it be? Sometimes there's a bracha to make upon seeing something, and if you don't see it, so then there's no bracha, and you don't have to see it. But if you do, there's a bracha to be made. For example, there's brachas to be made if you see mountains, if you see a rainbow, and if you don't see a rainbow, you don't. And if someone tells you there's a rainbow, you don't have to go outside and look. But if you see it, there's a bracha to make. Which means the seeing for those types of brachas, mountains and rainbows, is what generates the mitzvah of making a bracha. But there are other types of seeing that gives you a bracha. On Motzei Shabbos, when you see a flame, you make a bracha. Borei Ma'ori Ha'esh. But that's an obligation. That's a mitzvah. You can't make the bracha until you see the flame. But a person can't say, well, I'm looking the other way, and if there's a flame, that's kind of interesting, but when I see it, maybe I'll make a bracha. But it doesn't work that way, because there's a standing obligation. You need the flame in order to allow you to fulfill that obligation. So now the question is, what type of mitzvah is Kiddush Levana? What type of bracha is it? Is it the first type? If you look up and you see the moon and it's being renewed, make a bracha. And if you don't look up, so keep going. Or do we say, no, it's an obligation. You've got to wait for that time. It's like a Havdalah candle. You've got to wait till you see it, but be sure to see it. Seeing the moon allows for the bracha. It doesn't obligate the bracha. And the answer it seems quite clearly the second way, that it is an obligation which one needs to wait to see the moon in order to fulfill. How do we know this? Very simply, says Rav Osher Weiss, because when it comes to mountains and such like, there's only a bracha to be made immediately when you see the mountain for the first time or in a while. But if you saw the mountain yesterday, you can't make the bracha tomorrow. But when it comes to Kiddush Levana, you could see the new moon numerous times before you actually then make the bracha, Kiddush Levana. That tells you that it's a standing obligation for the time that it is. You just need to be able to see the moon in order to make the bracha. Okay, what's it all about? The Gemara in Sanhedrin, not Mem Gimel, Daf Mem Aleph, Amud Beis, and we say it in our Nusach of Kiddush Levana, it is called receiving the divine presence. Il male le zochi Israel el lahakup ne'avim shemayim pam achas b'chodesh dies. It's enough to receive the divine presence. Even would be enough even once a month. We happen to have the opportunity more than once a month, but even once a month, and that tells us that birchas halavana is called receiving the divine presence, and that is why we wear yom tov clothes and or Shabbos clothes more correctly. And that's really why it gravitates toward to Motzei Shabbos. It's not so much about the timing of Motzei Shabbos per se, but it's because people are wearing Shabbos clothes. That's the way to do it. The question is, how is making a bracha on the moon like receiving the divine presence? The Aruch HaShulchan explains, that when we talk about receiving the divine presence, it's about recognizing HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the way that he has arranged the world. We have certain daily phenomena, but when you have a cycle, a regularly repeated cycle, so that gives you a sense of how HaKadosh Baruch Hu is running the world. If you can perceive that from within all of these natural cycles, that's called receiving the divine presence. And in fact, that's why after Birkas Levana, we say Aleinu. And we just said Aleinu after Maariv. Do you say Aleinu again? Why? Because Aleinu is about a person recognizing, as we say, it's about recognizing Hashem's control not only of the heavens, but also of the earth. And therefore the main, if one could really say one thing about Birkas Levana, it's an act of recognition of Hashem's control of the world as expressed by the cycles and all the forces that he has set up. And that is why we conclude Birkas Levana with Aleinu. In fact, that's the reason why all davening finishes with Aleinu, although it was originally only in Musaf of Rosh Hashanah, but at a certain point it became for the conclusion of all davening. Because it's about a sense that a person leaves davening and goes back to earthly things. You've got to remember, Hashem is b'shamayim mimal, v'ala aretz mitachas. Our Rav Freund is fond of saying, and people think that talk about Aleinu as the conclusion of the prayers. But the truth is, Aleinu in principle is not a prayer. It's actually it's a song. The beginning of Aleinu L'Shaber, it ends with Alkei Nekaveh, but the bulk of the first part of Aleinu, it's not a tefillah, but it's a way of expressing our appreciation of our relationship with Hashem, which we just actualized through davening, and about to further do so. In his words, Aleinu is not a tefillah, and it's certainly not tefillah saderech, which I think is said in response to the fact that many people are already on the derech while they're saying Aleinu. So if Kupman once pointed out certain kehillas, they end the tefillah with Baruch Hu. And if you're not looking in the Siddur, you might not realize that Baruch Hu is written with a kaf, which means bless. But rather it sounds like Baruch Hu with a ches, which means run away. And people proceed to do their duty. In any event, with regards to the timing of Birkas Levana, from when to when? So the details are discussed, or many of the details are discussed in Maseches Sofrim, which is also an early work, post-Gemara, but an early work. And in the words of the Maseches Sofrim, when does one make the bracha? Mishetis basem halavana. From when, literally, basem is like from the word besamim, which means when it's pleasant, or we would say when it's geshmak, which actually is a translation of the word misbasim, which means when there's enough light, which is already a source of good feeling. It can't be just that sliver of on Rosh Chodesh. It's got to be something, which practically, according to Rishonim, becomes 3 days. Although Rabbi Yosef Karo in the Beis Yosef, he quotes one of the early Kabbalists, Rabbi Yosef Gikatilia, who says, and it's actually stated explicitly, al derech ha-kabbalah, based on Kabbalah, it's got to be 7 days. And that's why you'll find that there are, in a shul with the Sephardim and Ashkenazim, the Ashkenazim will already be saying Kiddush Levana, the Sephardim will wait another week because they're waiting for 7 days. That became the ruling of the Shulchan Aruch, 7 days, based on Rabbi Yosef Gikatilia, based on Kabbalah. Ashkenazim did not take the Kabbalistic approach here, and they go for 3 days. Although it is actually not three pure days in the sense that day one, two, three of the month, it happens to be that it is literally 72 hours from the time of the Molad. The Molad is what's announced in Mevorach HaNachodesh. They say exactly when the Molad is. Most people don't necessarily take note of that at the time, but sometimes the question as to, it doesn't make a difference what day Rosh Chodesh was, you really need to know when the Molad was, which means you need a good luach in shul, or you need a yeki in shul, and someone to tell you exactly when the Molad was, whether it's been 72 hours. So that's from when? From roughly 3 days, specifically 72 hours. The question is, until when? Again, says the Gemara, you make the bracha, ad shetismale pigimasa, until the deficit in the moon has been filled. As if to say, full moon, which is effectively the middle of the month. So now, the question is, so you have from the end of day 3 until day 15, roughly. Are any days preferred during that time? And here we come back to Maseches Sofrim, because some have the reading in Maseches Sofrim that when it spoke about Mivusam, it's about people. People should make Birchas Lavona on Motzei Shabbos k'shehein Mivusamim. So it sounds there that it really is about Motzei Shabbos. Everyone's in a good mood. Motzei Shabbos, they haven't heard their messages yet, that no one's bothering them. And everyone's, it's just that moment, or those few moments before things begin again. Everyone's besimcha over tuv lev. That's the best time to receive the divine presence. That's the best time to say Birchas Levana. And that's why people gravitate towards Motzei Shabbos. However, we should know that is a hidur, that is an enhancement of the mitzvah. Strictly speaking, Birchas Levana can be made on any night of the week that you see the moon. And in fact, this leads to a very interesting question, because we have certain values when it comes to mitzvahs, and sometimes they clash. For example, there's a classic value of a hidur mitzvah, to perform the mitzvah in the optimum way. Zekei liva anveil, hidur mitzvah. There's another value, which is called zrizin magdimin, the mitzvahs. You perform the mitzvah at the earliest possible opportunity. And from a certain point of view, that's also a hidur mitzvah. That's also enhancing the mitzvah by performing it as soon as you can. We learn that from Avraham Avinu, vayashkem Avraham baboker. Now, sometimes those two values can clash, because the earliest opportunity to perform the mitzvah isn't always the optimum time to perform the mitzvah. And case in point is Kiddush Levana. Because if we say that the best time to fulfill the mitzvah is Motzei Shabbos, but it could be that one is eligible to say Kiddush Levana from Monday. So those are 5 days that a person waits. Is it correct to wait? And this question was raised by the Truma Sadeshin, Rabbi Yisrael Isserlin, one of the great late Ashkenazi Rishonim. When you have a conflict between doing the mitzvah as soon as you can and in the optimum way, which do you choose? And the Truma Sadeshin gives a very interesting answer. He says it is better to wait until Motzei Shabbos. Performing the mitzvah in the optimum way overrides the concern of performing the mitzvah as soon as possible. However, says Truma Sadeshin, that is a principle answer. But sometimes there are practicalities. You've got to make sure there's no risk that if you wait till Motzei Shabbos, you might not see the moon again. For example, if it's in the winter, says Truma Sadeshin. Truma Sadeshin is in Poland. It's in the winter, and you see the moon, it's at whatever it is, the fourth or fifth day of the month, you might not want to wait. And therefore, says Truma Sadeshin, again, a practical answer, you have to leave yourself some backup days. And the Ramah says practically what that means is, if Motzei Shabbos is going to be before the 10th of the month, wait for Motzei Shabbos. Because worst case scenario, if the moon doesn't show on Motzei Shabbos, you still have 3 or 4 days spare, so to speak. But if Motzei Shabbos is going to be the 14th or the 15th, it's not worth it. You don't want to take a risk. Now that's the psak of the Ramah, and it depends on season, but it also depends on locale, as we can appreciate. The Aruch HaShulchan, who lived in the Varduk, which I guess was much more cloudy than where the Ramah were, Truma Sadeshin, I think, may have been in Germany, actually, but the Ramah is in the Cracker, there in Poland. The Aruch HaShulchan says, our minag is, in the winter months, if you see the moon, you do not hesitate. It doesn't matter, it's the 4th of the month, the 5th of the month, there could be 2 Shabbases left. You do not wish to take a chance. The moon has a reputation for appearing once, and then you might not see it again till next month. So all of these, as we can appreciate, it depends on locale, depends on circumstances. Now, there are further hidurim that accompany Kiddush Levana. And the Ramah says, for example, one should be outside. One should go outside to say Kiddush Levana. Why? Because once again, it is about receiving the divine presence. Well, if you receive the divine presence, so you should go out to greet Lechadodi. Right? You should go out to greet the divine presence, and therefore people should leave wherever they are and go outside to make Kiddush Levana. This too, however, is a hidur, as if to say it is not a strict requirement. It is possible, even for someone who is inside, to make Kiddush Levana, with the condition that he can see the moon clearly from where he is inside. But as long as he can, if the window's open, he can see, shutters are open, etc., it is strictly speaking, if a person can't get outside for whatever reason, he could make Kiddush Levana absolutely, even from inside. And the truth is that even if he sees through a window, and this is a question which is discussed by Poskim, if he sees through a window, as long as the window is clear and he's got a clear sighting of the moon through the window, it's also considered to be seeing the moon. The reason why this is a discussion is because there's a famous case in Maseches Rosh Hashanah of Edim, who came and they say for Rosh Chodesh reasons, they came and they say they saw the new moon, and the Gemara says if they saw it derech zechuchis via glass, it's not acceptable for testimony. That's not tantamount to actually having seen the moon, which makes it sound like if there's glass intervening, it's not called a direct sighting. But almost all poskim explain that when the Gemara disqualifies seeing the new moon through glass, it doesn't mean that you're looking at it and there's glass in between, but rather they saw it reflected off glass. As far as they're concerned, it's a good reflection, but that's not called seeing the moon itself. But if you're looking at the moon itself, even if there's glass in between, that is completely acceptable. Which, by the way, is good news for anyone who wears glasses, because everything they see is through glass. And as far as the halacha is concerned, that is considered to be a completely acceptable sighting. Further hidurim, the Prima Godim says, one should say Kiddush Levana with others. Barovam Hadras Melech, there's this concept, again, these are hidurim. It's considered an enhancement to be with others. How many others? Some say three, some say ten. These are the others. But now, with regards to the what we say, and there's many things that have been added, but in terms of like the core things that are added, the Ikar is the bracha, beginning with Baruch and ending with Baruch, Baruch Hashem, Mechadesh Chadashim, that's the Ikar. But there are certain things that have been added as a matter of minhag. And in fact, it can be a little bit disorientating because there's a certain point where we begin to say lots of things. It's almost a kaleidoscopic. We go from this and that, Keshem Chani Roked, and then we say, David Melech Yisrael Chai V'Kayam. What is the origins of saying that? Interestingly, the Gemara says in Maseches Rosh Hashanah that these words, David Melech Yisrael Chai V'Kayam, were the way that they used to tell others that it was Rosh Chodesh. There was a time, as we know, during Greek oppression and perhaps other times as well, one of the things that was targeted was Rosh Chodesh, and it was considered to be forbidden information to tell someone else when Rosh Chodesh was, and they could be punished for it. And therefore, the way that became accepted to let other people know that the moon had been seen and that today was Rosh Chodesh was to say, David Melech Yisrael, Chai V'Kayam. What's it got to do with Rosh Chodesh? Well, Rabbeinu Bachya explains that Malchus Yisrael, the concept of kingship with the Jewish people, actually is like the moon. Because in the same way that the moon reflects the light of the sun, so too kingship, as far as the Jewish people is concerned, it's never its own power base. It's always meant to be reflecting HaKadosh Baruch Hu's power. And therefore, the Malchus is like the moon. So therefore, then with the new moon, the way they would say it is by saying, David Melech Yisrael, Chai V'Kayam. Indeed, Rabbeinu Bachya, this is in Parshas Vayeshev, he tracks our history of Malchus, and to date, it actually waxed and waned over 15 generations respectively. That means to say, and he goes through the generations from Yehuda, which is where the beginnings of Malchus are, until the apex, which is really David and Shlomo, and you have 15 generations, and then there's a further 15 of decline, of waning, so to speak, until Tzidkiyahu, who is the final the final king until further notice. And that really is why we seem to be very concerned about the moon. We daven that the shortcoming of the moon should be replenished and its lacking should be made whole. L'malis b'givas halavana. Why do we care so much? But from a certain point of view, the destiny of the Jewish people, it's analogous. When we're davening that the moon should be made whole, we're davening that the Jewish people should be made whole. And that's why it's such a concern to us. Just the final point to mention, which also is a very... can arouse curiosity if we're not sure of the background. At a certain point in the Kiddush Levana, we turn to others and we say, Shalom Aleichem, three times. If you've never had Kiddush Levana before, it can be quite shocking if someone turned to you and say, Shalom Aleichem, especially as he never says hello to you in Shul. So what is behind the Shalom Aleichem? It literally goes from one thing to the other. But there is a very beautiful, and with this we'll conclude, a very beautiful comment from which is quoted from the Arizal. And that is, I mean, here we are, we're davening, the moon should be made whole, the world should be rectified, the Jewish people's situation should be rectified, and so on and so forth. But in a sense, the problems began with the moon. I mean, how, as far as our Masorah is concerned, how did the moon get into trouble in the first place? It had issues. It had power issues. Because they were originally Shneimos HaGadolim, they're both of equal size or equal potency, however that expressed itself, and the moon wasn't happy. There's not enough room for both of us. You can't have two sharing the same crown. Which was a point that was taken on board, and then the moon got demoted. Now becomes the Ma'or HaKatan. A lot of problems in the world, says the Arizal, we're paraphrasing, but they begin when a person says, there's not enough room for the two of us. And therefore, when we daven that the problems which started with the moon should be repaired, we got to do a bit of repairing ourselves. And part of that starts by turning to the person next to you and saying, Shalom Aleichem, because until now, there may have not been enough room in shul for the two of you. But if we really seek to for things to get better, we have to do our part. The first step starts by saying Shalom Aleichem. And I'd like to perhaps just add that the time to say Shalom Aleichem is when you've been mekabel pnei hashchina. And by that I mean, often it's the case, and again in a very general sense, but it's generally true, that the reason why we don't really allow others in or give them credence or give them room or give them credit is because we kind of feel that we're at the center of the world, and if they're not really playing their role, then they haven't really justified themselves, and often they just get in the way, and there isn't really room for everyone else. Part of what makes us say that there's not enough room for the two of us is because we feel that we're running everything, and naturally, therefore, we're in the center. The liberation that comes with the Kiddush Levana is the monthly reminder that we're not the ones that run the world, HaKadosh Baruch Hu runs the world. Once that's true, that's a burden off our shoulders. But not only is that the case, but we take a step back and we realize that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is at the center and there's room for many, many people around. And therefore, when you've been mekabel pnei hashchina and reminded exactly who's in charge and who is everyone else that revolves around them, all of a sudden your eyes are open. You can see the person next to you. There's room for the two of you, and there's room for more than the two of you, and you're able finally to say Shalom Aleichem. These, I believe, are sentiments that are well worthy of our consideration and contemplation, certainly as we're entering into a time where historically over the last few centuries are the Yemei HaMitzarim. We're always looking for how to brighten things up. Very often it starts with a step as simple as seeing the person next to us and saying Shalom Aleichem, and the rest can proceed from there. We'll leave it over there for the future.